Blog Talk Radio.
Sometimes I begin to wonder. Hello, everyone. This is Masonic Effects. So sometimes I begin to wonder how we ever came up with this story to life. The notion that their life would be so much better if I don't say that too easily, but you know what I mean. If only I was born a prince, or I had different opportunity, or I had married this one, or I'd made those. Like when we reflect on the choices that we make, it's often with this, this sense that what we have isn't what we deserve, but it's not too uncommon, and then we'll, hear Stoics will weigh in and say, shush, child, that's not the way a man goes about his life. Others will say, suck it up, buttercup, life is what it is. Then we clamor to try and put some meaning around it and bring life into focus sometimes. Sometimes when we're not struggling to survive, there's people, good people, decent people that don't have the same opportunity. They're brought into the world differently and their experiences are different and harsh and sharp. And they don't have the same sensibility of what's going on. Pundits of any kind of inclusive conversation, we'd say they'll point out that this seems to be elitist, but it only would be if I thought that the haves have an advantage over the have nots. That the have nots don't deserve more than or better than what their lot in life is. I keep wondering, to help frame this, I keep wondering what the world would be like, what life would be like if instead of, media, back it up to, thinking about early radio programs that morphed into television signals, that morphed into what we have today in social media and through computers. If this wasn't a vehicle for advertising and marketing, what would the world be like? I know, you can say, well, that's certainly a nice of you commie socialist, whatever. Well, over there, I might think about if you're saying that the common good is somehow derogatory. I disagree. I think there's inflammatory politics around all of this, but at the heart of it, this sense that, you know, we need to be able to help our fellow man to get along. It makes me wonder, are we just destined to be stuck defined in tribal limitations? You know, you tell me that I'm a tribe, and then you describe to me the tribe that I'm supposed to be in, and as if I don't, it's not a matter of selection or fate, or it just is. But son of a gun, the world is a little more complicated than that, and so are we. Are we destined our thinking to be relegated into tribal distinction? And then we can fill in the blank to explain why we do certain things, why we chafe, why we have difficulty. Well, the question is, why do we have difficulty with different? Where did the idea that a difference in a way of life or culture or faith should in some way be conflicted? We don't see this with the little people. You know, the experiments and the studies that have been done with children, we don't see this. Where we see pain in that age is pathology. You know, we see that there are, like all creatures, there is aberration, or you could say what's the word when something is morphing and turning into variation, eh? Variety, there's new strains, and that has to do with the changes in genetic coding and in DNA. And now we're finding out that and the clever children that we have, they figured out how to slice and change one of these little particles in our DNA, one of these elements, one of the genes, correct. Where do we get the, you know, I keep wondering, where did this idea that, you know, was I born with this idea that, you know, I'm somehow different than the rest, and that difference is wrong, or not my difference, my goodness, but your difference and his difference and her difference, and all those differences are somehow wrong. And I don't understand that. Truly, I don't. I like the diversity. I like the fact that some people do things differently, and it seems to allow me to allow a mind to expand. You have different tastes and styles on the East Coast, and but I'm here in the central part of the country. I'm not on the coast, right? Well, and I'm sure that's not a coast. So does somebody weigh in and assume to tell me that what's here is better than what's there? I can think as a moral. Well, I guess it boils down or step. You know, we unpack this a little bit. We need some exit ramps. Are we born with a sense of ethics? And are we morally and ethical creatures reach out to are we, you know, going to be fearful and tribal? I have inclinations like you do, but I don't. But I enjoy exploring I guess it's a confirmation about my moral rudder and whether I associate with people of a similar moral rudder deliberately, or is it just happenstance? I know that I do have a, like you, I have a sense of limit. There are people, regardless of what advantage, so-called advantage they may bring into my presence, I'll choose very carefully who I'm around. I think of that as trust. I'm not as trusting and naive as I once was. But I'm not sure it's trust. because you and I would have to sit down and talk about, or we stand up and talk about what that is. What is a trust? Is it familiarity? Is it submission? Is it submission and dominance? Is it yin yang? That I haven't sat down with people to talk about that. I've read about it. In other words, I've sat down in a way with other people, which I guess is partly the point of this, because a long time ago we were talking about concerns, putting things in writing. What if? Well, we can't have it, couldn't have it both ways. We couldn't continue on expanding mouth to ear without a little bit of assistance. And when somebody printed up a book, we could share an idea for the very first time. Instead of one person sharing with another person, we could share your idea with as many people as are diving into that copy of the written work. Ah. And did that serve a purpose? Or was it, oh, we'll just sit back and let that happen because somebody made it happen? Well, were there consequences of doing that? That's maybe a clearer way of bringing this into focus. Yeah. And yes, there is. Did anybody foresee what was coming? I think some did. Like you and I can speculate. And we could write down those speculations. Thank you, Dostoevsky. But some of the so-called speculations have merit. And some of them are uncannily consistent. And if you codified that in symbol, if that's how you did it, first I would think that would be an interesting mind, you know, to codify the essential knowledge. But if you did, I'd say, that's kind of interesting. What are you paranoid about? You're thinking that, you know, you have to share, you have to keep control. Is this about control of the good news, of the essential information? Or is it a way determining who gets it, knowing that I would think if the knowledge was put in the wrong hands, it could be manipulated, and you'd end up with a form of communication that's spent trying to tell me how to. That an algorithm or other people know better how I should use my time, what I should focus on, what I should be thinking, or that a businessman will be or a woman will be trying to sell something to me, constant sell, and or that the politic of the day will continue that sell, trying to sell an ideology or an idea or an explanation in exchange for a vote. Well, what if I don't under, there are those simple things like, you know, put on a wristwatch, I look at it and all of a sudden I'm telling the time. But if you ask me again what it is I'm measuring, I have no idea. And I dare say you don't either. Oh, well, so we'll just assume all of these answers, huh? We'll just assume. How's that working for you? How's that working for you? Now we get to the point of masonry here. Well, why would we be having a struggle? Why would masonry hereabouts be such a struggle? And why would we be hearing so much diffusion, as if the struggle, the clamor isn't there? That, well, I'm hearing the clamor and I'm seeing the clamor and I'm feeling the clamor. So my senses are telling me there's a clamor, but yours telling me no. There you go again. You've hit the wrong button. That's not clamor. You know, no, that's the wrong file. Put that away. This is joy. This is, as long as you don't look at all those things, this is wonderful. This is fulfillment. This is achievement of the purpose of Freemasonry. But hand in the air, what in the world is that? What is the purpose of it? Well, it correctly, is there one purpose? Well, those fellows way over there a long, long time ago found a purpose, and it hasn't resonated. It hasn't trickled down. Supply-side economics hasn't worked again. But, you know, there's a lot of very powerful people that will tell me otherwise. They could tell me it, but, you know, when you look at the math, it is what it is. You know, we know where that wealth comes from, and we know how, and we know what it takes to sustain those kind of systems. Do we have any kind of need to filter through, to apply these filters to our thinking today? Right, you are. Those filters didn't necessarily exist back in the 18th century or the 14th century. Whenever these discussions, you and I don't sit down together with some of our mates and say, you know, what filter are we going to apply to our conversation today? Clunk. That would be, you know, would you pour me a double here, you know, and keep them coming every time you see it. This is not going to be a good night. We don't talk like that. We don't. Somebody will, because, you know, you shake up the conversations over the course of many, many years. What am I doing? I'm working on 73 years. And you're bound to hear just about everything. And, you know, it doesn't always make sense at the time. But some of it is, it illustrates or reveals more than you necessarily want to know about people. You know what I mean? So do we in any way feel compelled to, if we don't understand the point of the order, to revere it, to understand what it is that we're holding in such high regard, if we've not shown any deference? Is it deference to it? Is that the right term? I guess a willful person would think that would come out with a sense of surrender. You're going to dominate me, and I have a free mind. Well, yeah, sure. How does that free mind, that innocent mind, like the school of art, the naive art? Untraining is no training is better, because it reveals more of a natural state of thinking. Well, we've been through that, and we found out that that's not exact. It's a nice hint, but it's not exactly accurate. So how do we value and preserve something that we don't understand and that we don't practice? It's a puzzle. I'm easily puzzled. But how do we do that? And should I expect, and I don't, should I expect that anyone would take time to give this a second thought because it's occurred to me? Well, why would you? Of course not. You have your own issues, your own focus, your own priorities. Those are yours. And yet we have this... We've defined ourselves, and I think that as we define ourselves, as soon as we define ourselves, we're setting limits. And have we defined ourselves too narrowly, and have the limits that have on the other side of those limits, we're coloring within the lines. Have we left too much of ourselves and our thinking, too much potential on the laboratory floor? Doing that? I think it's a reasonable kind of a question. What's the fascination? Well, look at, you know, I don't think we're going to find quick solutions. The more aware we are, like this social media, the media is creating this impression that the world has somehow become revolting. Or I would ask you this in all sincerity. It's like, when, you know, there's a state, a, a, a temporary heightened awareness about the violence that men perpetrate on women. Rates of crime, domestic crime increase. And the question is always smugly asked, is it actually an increase in violence toward our partners, our women? Or is it that we have, it's always been terrible, and now we have better reporting? Well, it is, I think, a legitimate kind of a question, and it can be answered. What are we doing with that awareness? Well, that's a good question for a group of men. That's a very, very good question. And if you hint at the M word, oh my goodness, the reaction, if you hint at that some of this conversation will be, bordering on misogyny, you'd be, you know, wouldn't be wrong. It requires a sensitivity and a delicacy and a capacity to absorb a natural reaction. You're not talking to people who are treated as equals. We're talking about people who have an axe to grind with us in some way, shape, or form. And the way that we demonstrate a capacity is by, I don't think it's as tolerance. I think it's a matter of respecting what a person has to say. That I think it's as simple as that. Do we have a responsibility? Yes. Yes. Yeah, we do. In the sense that we, when we put on, when we're wearing a symbol of our obligation, in other words, an apron, it obligates us to think more broadly. What we do, you know, in apron is seen by the outside world as reflecting a masonry. Inside, I don't think any one person speaks for us. And aside from the aggregate responsibilities of Grand Master, no one speaks more clearly about a man's insight than the man, a man's understanding than the man. No one. The fact that he wears an apron, it may be a determinant, but it's colored by the experience. How does the man relate to that? And what does he do with that awareness? So we don't plunge in. I don't think just frightens the bejeepers out of me when we begin anything with a jump into the deep end. You know, I don't, who does that? Well, maybe somebody that's getting paid to do it. Or somebody that finds, I prefer a degree of subtlety and persuasion and a respect, knowing that a dissenting point of view is fine. It's legitimate. It's encouraged. The difference is encouraged. That we're not talking about a tribal superiority and standing orders. We're talking about a purpose and meaning and trying to understand it. And begins, I think, toe in the shallow end. And use the water metaphor as widely as you possibly can. Tonight on Masonic Effects, we have a good program. We have the narrative movement. I think you'll find that you'll either laugh really hard or you'll go, what is this guy? Is this diet? What's wrong with this guy? The music, just sublime. But I've discovered a poetry, you know, and it's not like I'm grabbing anybody by the scruff of the neck and saying, here, pay attention to the detail. It's like when you pay attention to the detail, not if. Everybody does at some point. Maybe you're sitting in the waiting room while a dear friend or your wife of so many years is in having some important surgery, and you're wondering how it's going to go. And the laughter and the, it doesn't work anymore. It's like it's serious. And we do not control the fates. And you realize that. Or it's your child that's going through it. And this part of you, this heart, becomes more than just this a pump. It's more than a brain. It's a mind. It has a mind of its own, and it breaks. It has an emotion. And you have this, what is it? What feeling do you have? Is it a wake-up call or a horror that you never want to experience again, a fear that you may not have that person around again? Is it a joke? This time's to ease into it. You know, it's not like, well, you know, I know, you know, you grab a book of faith and you sit down and there you are. You throw a set of golf clubs in the trunk of the car, you're a golfer. But if I took all the books of the world and put them in the back of your car, that doesn't make you smart. That doesn't make you smart. You might have a really disorganized library there, but it doesn't make you smart. Do you pick up one and you read it? No, that doesn't do it. But what happens when somebody just blurts out an understanding? It's like, oh, whoa, there, wait, stop. We need, where did that come from? Where did that come? So I'm here on Masonic Effects to create a new sense of connection. So when you're thinking of the things of Masonic, you're not thinking about biting down on a piece of wood because you're going in and it's going to be tense and you have all these, and it's fraught with tensions. And you know, you want to pussyfoot around because we don't want the old boys going off into some kind of temper tantrum because they can't, they have difficulty controlling emotion. No, it's like, I want you to be able to think and share. I want to influence you. Yeah, be careful. I'm going to influence you, man. I want you to feel the dignity. I want you to feel the import, that something important is going on and that it's relevant. It has bearing. And if you want to make it painful, I'm not too interested. You know, I'm not too interested. You're the guys that want to strip down to your Speedo and jump through a hole in the ice to welcome in the new season. I salute you from the comfort of my warm perch, sitting here with an espresso, smiling and saying, you go for it. You know, there you are, right there behind you. But shit, I'm not. I think you've lost the plot there, boys. Join me. It's a good show today. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's poem, A Psalm of Life. Oof. This is like, no, it might grab me by the scruff of the neck, as I said. You don't, the attention to detail, when it happens, maybe a line, maybe a phrase. If you never looked at the pyramids, would you be any better off? If you never saw the Mona Lisa, would the world be different for you? Anyway, sit back. Masonic Effects. It's a good time. Keith Jarrett here. I thought about you. Yeah, he makes a point, doesn't he, Keith Jarrett? Masonry is it's just a different approach to problems, and I don't think I should expect that you would set down the tools that you've used to solve problems in life. And I don't think you'd throw them out the window. Well, here I'm wearing an apron and I've taken an obligation. All that I know and all the skills that I know that have helped me survive, well, they're meaningless. You know, I don't even have to give it a second thought. You know, somebody will tell me, somebody will show me. I don't have to reason through this anymore. Whew, what a relief. Nah. Beauty is truth. Truth is beauty. That is all you need know on earth and all you need to know. What was the poet John Keats thinking at the time that prompted this idea? It has been repeated often, as men tend to do when they are lost in thought. It isn't a declaration, I think, as much as a temptation. When I walk through an art gallery, I prefer the company of somebody keen to draw in the experience, especially when they interpret art and share their context. I find it a privately valuable moment. Why are some drawn to refinement of thinking while others not? Can one be remodeled? I tend to think it depends on what the individual can bring forward, whether it is a task or a joyful experience willingly begun. Isn't our religion intent on self-discovery? A philosopher might ask how we know our own nature and teach us about sophistry and Socratic method. But to know your own thoughts in our culture is a form of acceptance when so many algorithms are telling us they know better than we know ourselves. Imagine that. Trying to muster confidence in leadership to create order and form collective purpose has entered the age of global democracy. Ugh. It is a sticky, distempered clamor that right-minded men claim is the best form of accountability, democracy. But it is a process, both painful and cumbersome. Some lodges with like-minded gentlemen are able to make it work. Others chipping away at compromise and control walk hopefully along a precipice. Never stagnant. Never, never, never. It is organic and it moves right up to the time when it doesn't. It doesn't change personality. A fool is a fool is a fool. We don't argue with a fool. We don't tempt a fool. Nor would we deliberately allow a fool into the craft, except a fool isn't fearful. A fool doesn't operate according to finding reasons why not to do something. Bureaucracy is good at that. I mean, we do that bureaucratic nature. Throw out an idea. It's an easy litmus test. Throw out an idea and record the amount of the quantity of pushback. It tells us that we have an ability to more honed ability to find reasons not to do something than to find reasons to do something. I liken it to middle class parenting. Don't run with scissors. Don't climb that tree. Don't walk on the top of that wall. Don't take those risks. Things might happen. Well, at the end of it, the parenting becomes a little threadbare because fates don't change. Our luck doesn't change for anybody walking around thinking that somebody is, you know, actually that all of this, the order that we claim is in place is meaningless because of luck, to trivialize it. Or that if I'm devout, or if I've made my proper sacrifice in Athens, you know, each day, there's like a calendar. Each day, one of the gods was celebrated, and will be tied the person that gave up on that. Well, we know Socrates was very devout, you know, and kept up his devotions. And so you play it out. It's like something new is new. There's a novelty to it. But when you've seen it, you remember your first birthday when you were what age? And it was just so vivid and wonderful and easy and uncomplicated. After 70 of them, you've seen it, and it's like it's joyful and it's pleasant, but for different reasons, isn't it? The first time I flew, do you remember the first time you got on a plane? I love that surge, that energy, the endorphins. It's wonderful. Everything's keen. It's like it's a thrill. It's a bit dangerous, but it's a thrill. You know, it's exciting. That moment when you face it, it's excitement. It's not the fear of performance, it's the excitement of performance. And you know it. Do you remember that? And after 300 or 400 times on and off a plane, or 100 times, or 50, it's like, I know where to wait in line, and I know there's no rush. I'm not with the tourists getting to the front of the line. And if I can stand up just a few seconds longer, knowing that I'm going to have a 3 or 4 hour flight in a cramped little space, I kind of like to linger at the end of the line. You know, you learn these things. How to settle in and make yourself comfortable and, block out the noise. And we can wear a simple mask to filter out some unpleasant little things floating around, and put on headphones and just enjoy and sit back. But you don't rush to get off the plane because you've got to unpack. The baggage has to get from the plane to the handlers to. So how many times do you stand by a baggage carousel until you figure this out? You only need to be there when your bags are there. The thrill, yeah, I suppose it's interesting, but not so interesting. There are things, though, that we do that are remarkable, just absolutely remarkable. You go to a play, and you've seen it before, but you're there for what reason? The performance. To be captured, to allow your emotion and your mind to be captured by a script, by actors that are portraying that exquisite sincerity. And for a moment, it works. They create this intimate conversation with us. It's so beautiful. And then you go back. And whether that's, you find that with a symphony, you learn what was on his mind and how did he or she, what were the influences in the music? And you think back in this day, back in the 17th century, 18th century, these guys were the rock stars. They were writing. Nobody had done this before. They were creating, and the crowds, the clamor, the fame. Ah, wonderful. Do we take it all for granted? No. It's just apparently become more elitist. Well, there's a whole discussion, but you'd have to buy me a glass of Merlot, and we'll talk about that. I'd be very happy to hear your opinions about that. Movement, hey? Movement. Always in movement. Music That Never Should Exist by human beings that, where I am, were sold. But look at the beauty they created and gifted to the world. Fantastic. Fantastic. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. I wouldn't blame you if you began to think that all of the poetry that I talk about here was the product of these Ponzi affected rich kids. If that were the case, all these, you know, simple-minded, privileged kids that are around would all be tremendous poets, and they're not, are they? Some of them can barely count the money that they're spending. They've become quite irrelevant. And they seem quite happy in their irrelevance, yeah? This guy, Longfellow, was born in Massachusetts. It was a time before. Think of when the 1776 had passed, and the battles were still fresh, and there was still war going on. France was still coming up to its revolution, and the outbreak of civil war was happening. Civil wars were happening, and this guy, Kip, was born in Massachusetts of a time when there was, let's say, just coincidentally, less continental, more continental influence than, you know, Republic, influence of the Republic. But I say that, I just throw that out there. He attended private schools and the Portland Academy. And then he graduated from Bowdoin College in 1825. And he was, we know that he was especially attracted to Sir Walter Scott's romances and Washington Irving's sketchbook. And so from an, when he was influenced, he was fluent in translating that on graduation, he was offered a professorship in modern languages, provided that he would first study in Europe. Nice gig. So he went, you know, studied French and Spanish and Italian, but he refused to settle down to a regimen of scholarship at any university. You know, that tenured stream, a very, very male-dominated competitive environment. So in 1829, he returned to the States to be a professor and librarian at his college at Bowdoin. And he wrote textbooks, and he edited, and he translated poetry and prose. But he was writing essays in, you know, French and Spanish and Italian, but he wasn't feeling right. And then he was offered a professorship at Harvard with an opportunity to go abroad, and he accepted that. He went over to Germany in 1835. And on that trip, he visited England and Sweden and the Netherlands. Huh. But in 1835, his first wife died after just 4 years. And then it's claimed, if I should only be so lucky to have this claim made, he fell under the influence of German Romanticism. Ah, the inner man, the inner sense, nature. And it's understandable if you've been around a lot of German people, this joy, this sense of awareness. It's beautiful, of course. And he wrote the Song of Hiawatha, Paul Revere's Ride. So anyway, that's a bit about the guy. This poem is the song of a psalm of life. A psalm of life. It's a lyric of religious emotion. He published this in 1838. And it's taken from his first volume of poems. And the psalm is a sacred song, and an invocation to mankind to follow the path of righteousness. I wouldn't have a problem with that if it wasn't fire and brimstone. If you don't follow the every word, you're going to die. Well, it didn't work for me then. Now what? A deist, a pantheist, you know, what do I say? Mea culpa. The poet encourages his readers not to waste life, that life is short and is going to end soon. Good guy to have at the party, eh? Hey, don't drink that. Life could be short. You could walk out there and die tomorrow. Oof. But check this out and see what you think. Does it encourage you? He's encouraging to say that life is real and serious and all that. I don't know if he finds that atmosphere, if I found that atmosphere. But he says, you know, don't give up trying. You know, life doesn't stop until you're dead. Just keep trying. Dust thou art, to dust returnest. Check this out and see does he connect? And he's putting questions. Tell me not in mournful numbers. Life is but an empty dream. For the soul is dead that slumbers, and things are not what they seem. Life is real. Life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. Dust thou art, to dust returnest, was not spoken of the soul. Not enjoyment and not sorrow is our destined end or way, but to act that each tomorrow find us farther than today. Art is long and time is fleeting, and our hearts, though stout and brave, still, like muffled drums, are beating funeral marches to the grave. To the world's broad field of battle in the bivouac of life, be not dumb, driven cattle. Be a hero in the strife. Trust no future, however pleasant. Let the dead past bury its dead. Act. Act in the living presence, heart within and God overhead. Lives of great men all remind us that we make our lives sublime, and departing leave behind us footprints in the sands of time. Footprints, perhaps another sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn shipwrecked brother seeing, shall take heart again. Let us then be up and doing with a heart for any fate, still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor and to wait. Ah. Footprints that another, perhaps another, sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn and shipwrecked brother, I've been there, eh? Seeing shall take heart again, yeah? Footprints. Thank you. There are times when we find things quite beautiful about masonry, and some of them I wish that, you know, of course, that more people would experience that. And the history that we're going to go over today tells us a bit, hints at that. We're still tucking into the Lodge Le Bien Ami in Amsterdam in 1755. What could we possibly learn from that experience? But, even at the time, the historian that's dissecting this period in time was mindful that of the work going on in the lodge, that that there was a tradition happening that required, the masons went to a brother named Roussette, who was considered an authority to pass on the legitimacy of masonry by introducing his successor. And what we saw was the authority being passed to the master out of the hands of his predecessor that had been, and this means that we have unanimously consented. And so it's been chosen by public suffrage. You know, you don't have to, you're free to make your, and then we can all pile on and grumble about, you know, the flaws of character, but not us. You know, and we've done nothing to prepare the person or to extract meaning and to support, but we can find fault. But here we're told we may associate his legitimacy with theories of governance that are traditional and patriarchal, hereditary even, as well as they are modern, as in a Lockean sense. You should study that, John Locke. Interesting. The contractual and elective. Not least, the brothers were asked to accept the result of their public vote, to hear witness to it publicly. And in the lodge at this moment, the private has become public. In every lodge, and Le Bien-Aimé was no exception, the brothers constituted the lodge for themselves and then submitted willingly to the authority of the master. Again, the emphasis here is on self, on individual, on responsibility, not an overseeing, an overarching authority. But see how that is reflected. The brothers requested the reestablishment of the lodge. And once it was reestablished, they were dutifully attentive to Roussette's instruction, incorporating them into the elaborate set of household rules used to guide the behavior of all brothers. Yet within 2 years, the brothers, now over 50 strong, declared that they did not regard the old constitutions and rules of England as fixed and unchanging bases of their work and behavior. They regard them as good helping aids to be used when necessary as a first point of deliberation, and then to use them as far as the character of business agrees with the constitution of the order in this country, as well as with the respective lodges in particular. This flexibility appears to have been a response to the increasingly national character of Freemasonry within the Republic. By contrast, however, over the years, Roussette's lodge would tend to support the preservation of English ritual and oppose departures from this ancient orthodoxy initiated by the Grand Lodge. It would also demand the right to enter into opposition and to protest if changes were too hurriedly adopted. I think this makes grand sense. And I've often thought that I have an interpretation, and lots of interpretations handed to me, but this one most captures my thinking about the relationship of the old constitutions and rules. So are they fixed and unchanging bases of our work and behavior? Well, I would say, how could they possibly be? But aren't they in fact aids that are to be used when necessary as a first point of deliberation? A first point of deliberation. I think that makes sense. It makes more sense, and it has more appeal than the sense of something rigid, which is the way I read, I'm inclined to read, fixed and unchanging basis. So I would think, are you, you know, fixed and unchanging is a reenactment. And there are parts, I think, that we can extrapolate, not generalize. But there are things that this spirit, if that's fixed, that spirit, the joie de vivre, that sense of that immersion into the philosophy of Freemasonry, I think if that's what's meant, you know, I need some qualifiers here. I don't see this in a militaristic sense. Now, although people from the military find the camaraderie just, you know, wonderful, and so does a lot of other people, but Masonry asks that we take ourselves a little higher than that. Oh, you may just see the uniform while I see the acknowledgement. But you and I are asked to be cradled in the hand of this thoughtfulness and rise above the clamor. Going to be penalized or punished for asking questions in life. You may not get the answers you want to hear, and you will see if somebody is just trying to. You know, you'll see the process, the human process, and very, very openly and honestly, raw. You'll see people trying to promote an answer or response, resting on their authority or their celebrity. When philosophically we know that authority doesn't give legitimacy to an opinion or is no source of truth. We could dissect that by looking at what we mean when we talk about authority. Again, terms are really important, that we have some agreement so we can know what it is we're discussing. Often we're on different wavelengths. You know, there's different frequencies, and it makes it impossible to synchronize when we do that. The interesting thing is what is revealed when we begin asking questions. You can walk around rashly with that, aha, I knew it all the time moment. Or as you are a Mason, there's a sense of conduct, a sense of decorum. My goodness, carry yourself with a bit of subtlety. Do you never play chess? Express your moves facially or with tells before you even take them? Well, why are you even sitting down at the board? You know, you do that in life. You don't know how to be discreet or how to control. You have no sense of temperance. You know, there's a time and a place for that. So everything emotional is good and everything logical is bad. Is that the general rule? So we even use language that is it's extraordinarily affected, bigger than life. And I can't help thinking when somebody's telling me that somebody is exceptional, that in fact they're probably very good at what they do, and that's fine. Exceptional. Well, you've got to prove that. You've got to be capable of it. And it's not that somebody tells me this fellow is exceptional. Well, what makes him exceptional? Well, isn't that what we expect? Often what we describe as exceptional is what we expect in everyday life. And are we really saying that just a person performing what's expected of them is a surprise? It makes them exceptional. Is that talking about the person, or are we talking about our own reluctance or cynicism? I'm surprised when somebody actually follows through. So let's describe them as exceptional and try and embellish through language. It's like a superstar. Somebody's a good musician and they can get through the piece without stumbling through, and they can hit their note, and they have a sense of entertainer about them. That's wonderful. So it's wrong of me then to live in a world that is normal. It's wrong of me to find magic. Is that the way this is, life is, masonry is? That if I find contentment and magic in the ordinary things of life, that somehow I'm missing something? What's your proof? I hope you've enjoyed the show. I hope it gives you reason to pause sometimes, or you know, food for thought. If only we could sit in lodge together and discuss at length. So come back and visit. You know, this, it's like nothing is ended till it's ended. And I am one of those Masons that subscribes to this notion of connectivity. We don't just pop up at a certain age or point of awareness. We have these associations, and those associations have associations. And if we trace all that contact and that connection back in time, it's pretty remarkable. It's pretty remarkable. And then to say, well, I'm significant and I'm special, I'm beyond all of that. Well, tell me what it is first. I'm sure that you are. I'm sure that you're exceptional in every way. But would you mind explaining to me just a bit about your background? Because I might find that very, very appealing and very interesting and very revealing. And I'll try and do my own, you know, again. Thank you for tuning in. It's been interesting as usual. And, of course, I love the show set up like that. Why would I do it and try and not make it interesting in a Masonic context? come back. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. Ciao, Bella. Thank you.